Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Tricia Beatty. Today I'll be reading from the April 8th issue of the Christian Science Monitor. In the limited time we have, I'll read from their section called One Week, which is a series of brief articles and commentary on the top stories of the past few days. Delhi. Modi's approach to welfare earns him votes, but does it help India? By Sushmita Pathak, contributor. For years, Kuzma cooked on an earthen stove for her family of six, stirring pots placed over firewood on a short, U-shaped clay structure. She had to inhale toxic smoke that turned the roof of her one-room shanty gray. Until December, when a red cooking gas cylinder and new steel cooktop arrived at her doorstep. "We felt very good that day. The kids were also happy," she recalls, keeping one eye on the lunch she has stewing in a pressure cooker. Kuzma, who like many in India goes by one name, is among more than 100 million Indians who've received cooking gas connections under one of the federal government flagship welfare programs. It's part of an ambitious welfare agenda that Prime Minister Narendra Modi has rolled out since coming to power in 2014. Hundreds of programs now deliver benefits: electricity, affordable housing, toilets, and cash, to roughly 950 million people across the country. Late last year, Mr. Modi's government announced that a program providing free food grains to more than 800 million Indians will continue for five more years. Coupled with a Hindu nationalist push, Mr. Modi's populist welfare agenda has helped him expand his support base and will play a key role in general elections, set to begin April 19th. Welfare programs are at the front and center of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party's, BJP, advertising campaign these days. And opposition parties are taking note, unveiling their own promises. This is a free-for-all when it comes to welfare schemes in Indian politics, says political scientist Sanjay Kumar at the Delhi-based Center for the Study of Developing Societies. In a country with high inequality and widespread poverty, it's a sign of a healthy democracy that this is what governments would like to compete on, says Yamini Ayar, president and CEO of the Center for Policy Research in Delhi. But Ms. Ayar and others say the Modi administration's approach to welfare often falls short. The new programs provide immediate relief, but fail to address structural issues that block the country's poorest from a path to long-term prosperity. Professor Kumar says the BJP has made enormous electoral gains through the expansion of welfare programs. Between 2014 and 2019, the vote share of the BJP increased across all economic classes, but the jump was highest among poor voters, 12%. While upper caste Hindus have been traditional supporters of the BJP, new welfare programs have helped the party win over low caste and tribal voters too, many of whom are poor, he says. While welfare has always been part of Indian politics, what is new, according to Ms. Ayer, is the use of technology. Mr. Modi's policies have homed in on cash handouts deposited electronically to people's accounts. The amount of direct cash transferred in 2019 and 2020 was over 28 times the amount in the year before Mr. Modi took office, and the number of beneficiaries in the same period grew sixfold. The nature of benefits has changed as well, with more focus on providing private goods like cooking gas cylinders rather than on providing public services like health or education, which traditional welfare programs tend to center around, says Ms. Ayer. Mr. Modi's brand of welfare politics is also very personalized. At several metro stations and other public spaces around Delhi, posters splashed with Mr. Modi's face boast the benefits of his welfare programs. Gas pumps have selfie points where customers can take a photo with cardboard cutouts of the Prime Minister alongside a larger-than-life red cylinder. The official names of many programs begin with Pradhan Mantri, or Prime Ministers, leaving little room for doubt about whom to give credit. This form of welfarism, Ms. Iyer says, shifts the balance of power between citizens and the state. Increasingly, we talk about welfare less in terms of rights, but much more in this patrimonial kind of framework, where the welfare is being given as a kind of patronage or a charity to the poor, says Ms. Iyer. You're telling people that they're just beneficiaries of a program, as opposed to rights-bearing citizens who have full socioeconomic rights that they can demand of the state. Thanks to her new cylinder, Kuzma no longer has to go into the forest to collect firewood, nor does she have a coughing fit before every meal. But she worries about the day the gas runs out. Even at a subsidized rate of roughly $7, a refill costs more than what Kuzma's family, which includes four children, can afford. Her husband struggles with drug abuse and disappears for days, she says. Either I'll have to leave my baby and go to work, or go back to cooking on firewood, she says. She wants the government to further reduce the cost of cooking gas. Free food grains or subsidized gas may help people in the short term, Professor Kumar says, but are not changing their fortunes in the long run. He says the current welfare policy lacks vision. Ms. Iyer agrees, noting that no political party in India has been able to resolve two key issues: a lack of investment in health and education, and limited employment opportunities, which together hinder social mobility. Santosh Kumar, who lost his job as a quality checker at an eyewear company during the COVID-19 pandemic, feels this failure acutely. After struggling for years to find work and surviving on ration kits provided by non-governmental organizations, he and his wife now sell dumplings by the roadside. They received a loan of roughly $120 under a welfare program for street vendors, but the money is hardly enough to cover rent, food, school fees for his kids, and the costs to run his business. On paper, the government says we have done so much, but in reality, what are we getting, he asks. The poor are being squeezed from all sides. Shortfalls aside, when asked who she will vote for in the upcoming election, Kuzma is quick to answer, Modi. Basel, Switzerland. Why Spain is Trusting Trans Teens on Their Gender, by Dominique Sogel, special correspondent. Dictator General Francisco Franco's rule was a grim era for Spain's transgender community. At the time, a trans person could be taken from the streets to prison without any chance to consult a lawyer and be kept there for as long as a judge saw fit, recalls Mar Cambrole, who has been fighting for trans rights since General Franco died in 1975, and now is president of the transgender rights association Federación Plataforma Trans. A Franco mindset no longer shapes Spain's view of gender identity. Just in the last 20 years, the country has undergone a radical shift in how it perceives its transgender community, particularly trans youth. Last year, the country adopted legislation allowing anyone age 12 or over to change their legal status to match their gender identity, though those under 17 would need judicial or parental consent, depending on their age. Tragedies like the recent death of high schooler Nex Benedict in Oklahoma have drawn fresh attention to the rights and experiences of trans teens. Some jurisdictions, including a number of U.S. states, are tightening laws against changing gender identity. But in Spain, the desire to protect youth has produced the opposite response. 10 years ago, trans people were seen as sick people in Spain, says Inguru Mayor, author of the book Transitos, which draws on the testimonies of parents with trans children. But children do not generate the same rejection that adult trans people generated. They appeal to society's instinct to care for its cubs. And now, across Europe, there is broad acceptance of trans people in society, including allowing them to change their legal status to match their gender identity, which 62% of Europeans support, according to Eurobarometer data published in December. Some European countries, which have been historic leaders on LGBT rights, like same-sex marriage, are recognizing that trans people have been excluded from some of the advances that have occurred in the last 2 decades, says Christian Gonzalez Cabrera, a senior researcher at Human Rights Watch. These populations have unique needs, and there is a shift to be increasingly inclusive and intersectional, and finally address the historical debt that many countries have to this historically marginalized group. Ivan, who was assigned female at birth, resented wearing pretty dresses to weddings as a child. As a teen, he wore makeup and feminine attire, but felt like he was role-playing. He cringed when called by his birth name. But by chance, in 2020, while getting a COVID-19 vaccine, someone referred to him using a masculine pronoun. That moment felt fantastic. I liked it so much, I had to ask myself why, he says. So when Spain's new law on gender self-identification came into effect, Ivan, then 16 years old, wasted no time setting up an appointment to change his information in the Spanish Civil Registry. Ivan, whose last name is being withheld, valued being able to start the process discreetly, without looping in his parents, although in the end, his mother accompanied him to formally present the request. The law was a miracle, to be honest, says Ivan. It struck me as positive that young people who are not emancipated can start the process on their own. There are cases of parents kicking out their children because they are trans. Making the change at 16, rather than 18, meant the opportunity to earn a high school diploma that aligned with his sense of self. Once I came out, I had no more doubts, he shares on a WhatsApp call taken during a break from studying chemistry in the town of Galicia. Just a month after the law went into effect, Ivan had shared his identity at home and at school. It went smoothly. Only one of his brothers struggled initially with Ivan's identity and new name, thinking the change may have been a passing phase inspired by TikTok. Going to an association to support the family of trans youth helped allay his parents' nerves around the health consequences of hormonal treatment. It seems to be a recent thing that people can talk about it, he says. Before, maybe you got killed or a beating. Now there is more protection or support, so more people dare to come out. An outcome like Ivan's would have been inconceivable even a decade ago. Until 2013, the concept of a trans child was virtually unheard of in Spain. That changed in large part because the work of the country's first association for family with trans children and adolescents, Chrysalis. The organization provided vital support to trans youth at a time when the knowledge of psychologists, psychiatrists, and social workers on trans identities was still anchored on the concept of it being a pathology. It was a reality that you couldn't even imagine until then. It seemed like trans people didn't have a childhood, that they just came out in adulthood, says B. Seaver, president of NAZEN, the Basque and Navarre Association of Families with Trans Minors. However, if you listen to their story, you'll realize that they all tell you, "I knew it since I was little, even though I didn't know how to put words to it." Some of these families shared their stories with the public, helping others to come to terms with the reality they were facing. In Spain, there are more and more families that can accompany their sons, their daughters, because they know that what their sons and daughters are expressing is possible, says Mr. Mayor, the author. Experts say such activism was crucial for paving the way to Spain's gender self-identification law. They also point to the prominence in recent years of various trans personalities in music, film, and television for helping familiarize society with their struggles. In the end, the self-identification law passed with a firm majority. Though there was acrimonious debate over the law, it played among the left-wing parties, says Javier Corral Diaz, a journalist who wrote his thesis about its reverberations on social media. Anti-trans feminists raised concerns that trans rights gains could come at the expense of women. The core of the debate revolved around whether sex is a cultural construct or something truly natural, he says. But the right and far-right parties kept relatively quiet. Mr. Corral suggests that may be a sign of progress in a country where social mores were once shaped primarily by the Catholic Church. That's not to say there hasn't been pushback. While the national government and many regional governments may enable young trans people to legally express their identities, a few regions do not have laws recognizing such trans rights. These regions still do have to recognize the genders recorded in the National Registry, but their lack of such legislation, or in the case of Madrid's regional government, their repeal of trans rights laws in December, indicates there is still a conservative backlash against gender identity laws. Still, the rise of associations helping families of trans children has helped society to see trans people in a kinder light. It is never the parents who want their children to be the sex they don't appear to be, or another sex, says Joaquin Zuratuza, the father of a 13-year-old girl. She was assigned male at birth, but socially transitioned at age 9 with the support of her parents and school. It's not that we parents are extra progressive parents who like these things, he adds. No, we are normal moms and dads, and we want our son to be a son and our daughter to be a daughter. But more than that, we have to be loving people to our children, and love has to be above all else. Washington. War tore Ethiopia's diaspora apart. Peace activists are stitching it back together. By Ayen Deng Bior, contributor. On a warm spring day in March 2021, the Queen of Sheba restaurant in the Los Angeles' Inglewood neighborhood got an unexpected visit from the city's health department. It was the first surprise visit by health officials in the restaurant's 7-year history. Soon, things got even stranger. Over the next few months, officials showed up unannounced again and again. Salem Mengesha started to ask questions. When we asked why they were visiting so many times, they said that they were receiving anonymous calls complaining that the restaurant was unclean, says Ms. Mengesha, whose sister owns Queen of Sheba, and who has worked there on and off since its opening. While all this was happening, Ms. Mengesha noticed another troubling trend. Once charmed by Queen of Sheba's commitment to promoting their culture through food, Ethiopians had mostly stopped patronizing the restaurant. The reason could be traced to a civil war happening more than 9,000 miles away, in the Mengesha's homeland. The family's origins are in Ethiopia's northernmost region, Tigray, where fighting had pitted the local community against the national government. As soon as the war broke out, the residents' non-Tigrayan Ethiopian clientele completely stopped coming, Ms. Mengesha says. More than 3 years later, even though fighting in Tigray has formally ended, violence continues in other parts of the country, and divisions like this linger in communities across Ethiopia's global diaspora. However, even as misinformation continues to fuel mistrust, a small but determined group of Ethiopians is pushing back. From peace conferences to podcasts, they are working to heal their fractured communities however they can. For nearly three decades, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, was Ethiopia's ruling party. As a result, although Tigrayans make up just 6% of Ethiopia's 110 million people, they dominated the country's politics, military, and economy. Resentments built, and in 2018, other parties from the ruling coalition unseated the TPLF and chose a non-Tigrayan prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, for the first time. The TPLF was incensed, tensions grew, and eventually a TPLF assault on government military bases in November 2020 sparked a civil war. To date, as many as 600,000 people have died as a result of the conflict, and 5 million more have been displaced. Now, fighting has mostly ended in Tigray itself, but violence has broken out elsewhere, and Tigray remains in the midst of a devastating hunger crisis that aid agencies warn could become famine. Over the past 3 years, the war's tensions have also spilled over into the diaspora. Ms. Mengesha began experiencing them just months after fighting started, when she attended rallies calling for a ceasefire and protection of civilians in Tigray, where her extended family still lives. Immediately, she says, she began to receive social media comments from strangers calling her a spy and saying that her community deserved violence. The messages rattled her, but she didn't think her trolls would go further. That is, until the barrage of unfounded complaints about Queen of Sheba's hygiene levels began. The war very much fragmented the social fabric amongst Ethiopians, says Miaza Gedei Gemeremedin, an anti-war activist from Tigray who lives in the Washington area. You see people associating with their ethnic group and forming their own private and smaller community centers, rather than a bigger Ethiopian community. In part, people closed rank around their communities in response to the appalling violence against civilians that occurred on both sides of the conflict. International observers have found substantial evidence that both Tigrayan and Ethiopian forces have committed war crimes, including the mass rape and murder of civilians. But the tension and mistrust was also deepened by disinformation, many say. I saw the media, the diaspora media, the church media, everyone was warmongering, says Getachew Assefa, a professor of architecture at the University of Calgary with Tigrayan roots. That shocked me to the core. In response, he decided in mid-2021 to start a news platform devoted to spreading accurate information about the war in Tigray and advocating for an end to the killing of civilians on both sides. UMD Media, short for Understanding, Measuring, Doing, publishes articles and hosts panel discussions. Today, it reaches more than 30,000 subscribers of multiple ethnicities, faiths, and countries on YouTube, and sometimes broadcasts by satellite into Ethiopia and Eritrea as well, Dr. Assefa says. The vast majority of people are at peace with each other, says Moges Teshome, an Ethiopian PhD student living in Vienna. Like Dr. Assefa, he believes amplifying these voices is the only way forward. The social fabric has not been totally torn apart, he says. The trust is deteriorating, but it is still there. About a year ago, Mr. Teshome, who studies ethnic conflicts at the Vienna School of International Studies, began recording a podcast to support his message. Buffet of Ideas, which focuses on politics and peace in Ethiopia, now has more than 40,000 subscribers on YouTube. There are other flickers of hope, too. Last July, diaspora members from different Ethiopian ethnicities came together for a peace conference in San Diego. In October, a coalition of diaspora groups in the United States published a list of demands aimed to bring fighting across Ethiopia to an end, including the release of political prisoners and a national dialogue. The scar of war is still there, says Mr. Teshome, but there is hope. There is a possibility for dialogue and possible reconciliation. Numbers in the news. 800 bullets per minute, at the least, that can be fired when a semi-automatic weapon is outfitted with a conversion device to make it automatic. The prevalence of these switch devices has sharply increased in the United States in the last few years and is fueling a rise in gun violence, says law enforcement. 10. Countries or territories worldwide that meet the World Health Organization's health standards for air clear of fine particulate matter, particles of pollution small enough to enter the bloodstream. The countries that meet the guidelines are mostly small islands, as well as Australia, Finland, and Estonia. 72. Percentage of U.S. teens age 13 to 17 who say they often or sometimes feel peaceful when they don't have their smartphones. At the same time, 44% report feeling anxious without them. 158. Cherry trees in Washington that will be felled to make way for a seawall around the city's tidal basin. Rising sea levels have flooded many of the trees during high tide. 200. Women applicants last year for a female safari guide training program based in Botswana, run by African bush camps. Several programs have cropped up on the continent aimed at facilitating women's participation in the traditionally male-dominated industry. 6,000. Residents who will be able to move into the Athletes Village complex in Paris after the 2024 Olympics are over. The 128-acre complex was designed with sustainability features like timber buildings and sidewalks paved with oyster shells to keep them cool. By Mackenzie McCarty, staff writer. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the April 8th issue of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Tricia Beattie. So long for now.